What is going on, everyone? Welcome to A Theology of Hustle. This is episode 42, and I am talking to Susan. Now, I came across Susan because of a couple of my previous interviewees. If you remember Michelle McKinney pretty early on, she has actually worked with Susan for a long time. And then my friends Anne-Marie and Roger have started Through the Sea, which is, sort of a home company, like around the table, with a mission of giving back to foster care. And the organization that both Michelle works with and Anne-Marie and Roger work with is called National Angels. And I'm talking to Susan today, who is the founder and CEO of Austin Angels, which National Angels kind of comes out of. So this is another episode about foster care. I'm just going to warn you right now, before you get into this episode, that if you listen to this episode, you are going to be burdened, I guess is the best way to say that. You're going to be burdened for these foster care children in foster care, because Susan is so burdened for them. She's going to draw you into that. It is just incredible. Her life basically hinges on one moment with one friend speaking truth to her, and her life has basically never been the same. And she just has a passion and a drive for kids in foster care that's just incredible. You are going to love hearing from her, her passion, her drive. She has a goal to have one of her organizations in each and every major metropolitan city in the U.S. I mean, that is like lofty goals, and she is getting after it. And I think the work that they're doing is absolutely incredible. If you know anything about me, if you've listened to any of these episodes, adoption and foster care is huge on my heart. It's something that sort of drives me, and hearing from Susan, just push me even further into that understanding that we have got to be doing something for these kids. We just have to. So you're going to love this interview. I'm excited for you to hear from her. One housekeeping bit, though, before we get started. On Aaron Moon's episode a couple ago, I promised that I would send out a newsletter with information on the church calendar. So if you don't know what the church calendar is, if you've never really lived by it, whatever, I wanted to send out some information. I started looking around and found nothing out there that I really liked and like looked good and all that stuff. So being a three, I just created one. So if you sign up for my newsletter, and those of you who are already signed up for my newsletter, you will get a PDF that sort of walks you through the church calendar. There's a graphic that you can sort of look around and sort of breaks up all the seasons and explains them. I think it's helpful. It gives you a lot of great resources for learning more about the church calendar on there. If you're interested, it's something you might want to check out. It's free. You're getting this free PDF, no strings attached, except I get your email address. So, and then you get to stay up to date with Theology of Hustle. I mean, it feels like a win all the way around, honestly. So, so do that. So you can sign up at my website, curryblandford.com. There's a sign up bar right there. If you think about it, go ahead and leave me a rating and review on whatever platform you're listening to this podcast on. That's always super helpful. I also want to hear from you. So if you're not following me on Instagram or Facebook or whatever, please do so at Theology of Hustle. I'd love to hear from you. I'd love to hear, what episode you're really enjoying and all that stuff. I love chatting. I love interacting. So I'd love to do that. You can find all that information on my website and all that stuff. So I hope you really enjoy this episode with Susan. I'd love to hear what you thought. So here we go. Hey, Susan, it is so good to meet you in person, I guess via computer, but yeah. So good to meet you.
Same.
I'm excited to talk foster care and all that stuff and your story. Your story looks incredible. So do you mind jumping off by just sort of introducing yourself to us a little bit?
Yeah. So I am the founder and CEO of what is Austin Angels. And then last year kind of transformed into National Angels. And the reason it transformed into National Angels is because we are now a national nonprofit with chapters in 22 different parts of the country. And the exciting part is that we are are only going to continue to grow. So our growth plan is pretty aggressive and ambitious. And that is that we want a chapter in every major metropolitan city across the country so that every family can be served and every child would be in our program.
Wow.
Yeah.
That vision is just incredible to me. I love it.
Yeah.
I love that you're a person of vision. I mean, it sort of radiates. How did you go, though? How did all this sort of get started, you know, back in the day?
Yeah. So we actually started Austin Angels in 2010 with the hopes of just wanting families to be supported, and we wanted children to experience care differently. And so I had spent 8.5 years in a career that I thought I would be in forever. So my vision was not to start a nonprofit. That was definitely not in my radar. And I had a pretty good job and really felt just called a few years in to do something more with my life. And so I started by doing just one volunteer event, just one day a month. And then I had sold a home to a woman who was a CPS worker who invited me to a conference. And I had kind of felt like in my life that adoption was going to play some role. And so she had said, "Hey, there's a foster and adoption conference. Would you like to go with me?" And I said, "Yeah, I'd like to go." And we had a breakout little session, all these different kind of classes that you could go into. And I was circling all the ones for adoption. I had really felt like I wanted to go to these. And she said, "Well, I'd like you to go and listen to this judge speak on foster care because I'm in his courtroom all the time. And he's the number one presiding judge over all the court cases that has to do with foster care." And I said, no, I'm not really into that. I don't know how to love on children, let them into my home, and then have them leave. And she said, "Well, you know, Susan, the interesting thing about foster care is that it's not really about you. And wouldn't it be nice for someone like you to open up your home?" And so I said, "Okay, fine, I'll go." And, you know, it was at that moment, and I don't know how many times in your life, like the one decision you made completely changed your whole trajectory in life. But for me, it was at that conference, and it was because of a story that the judge had told. And he virtually had told a story about two little boys that had come in and out of his courtroom that had taken lots of abuse and lots of neglect. And ultimately what happened was that both of the boys ended up in a residential treatment center, and one of them aged out. Just a few days before he was aging out, the director comes to him and says, "Son, you have been adopted." And he says, "What do you mean I've been adopted? I wanted to be adopted my whole life, and that never happened for me." And he said, "You've been adopted, and your father will be here soon to get you." So the young man stands on the steps of the residential treatment center and irons his shirt and was waiting for the dad. And the dad comes to him and he says, "Son, I am sorry that it has taken me 18 years to find you, but you will never have to worry about where you go from here, that you are my son until the day that I die." And what was remarkable was that young man moved in with them, and they put him through school and they put him through seminary school. And he actually grew up to create one of the largest foster and adoption agencies in the state of Texas. And you hear that story and you say, "Hey, praise God, that's amazing. Even at 18 years old, there can be hope and redemption." But the other little boy's story was virtually identical, but he turns 18 years old and there's no one there to rescue him. There's nobody in his life that really spoke truth. And you know, there's so much fluidity in foster care. So the turnover rate of foster homes, and I think in his story, he had said there was like 23 different placements in his life. And wow. So when he turns 18 years old, he leaves the residential treatment center and he just begins to walk and walk and walk until he can find the nearest freeway. And he throws himself in front of an 18-wheeler and he commits suicide. And the judge said at that moment that not everybody's called to foster and not everybody's called to adopt. But what was that little boy supposed to grow up and become? And it's such a disservice that we do this to the kid, to our kids and our community. What happens is that these kids go into foster care and they're more likely to fail than they are to succeed. And I just believe that we can do better than that. And I left that conference feeling the weight of the world. I left as if God had said to me, "Now this is your burden to bear, and I want you to do something about it." So I left that conference in 2010. And for the next few years, we just had children experience care differently by throwing service projects. And that felt great and good. But the truth is that we began to have the conversation that while this is great and good, the truth is that this doesn't change children's lives. And they're still going to end up at 18 years old and end up as one of these statistics. So how do we rewrite that? And that's when we launched the program that we do today that serves thousands of children all over the United States. So that's the long-winded answer of how do you get it?
No, that's great. I think what you're saying, it's incredible to me how one moment can just change everything, mm-hmm. like you and the trajectory of your life. I mean, it's just incredible because you always think like change happens long-term, right? That, you know, you're working on somebody, but God's like, when God's ready for you, God's ready for
you. That's right. Whether you're ready or not.
Yeah. That's exactly. You better get on board.
That's right. It's go time.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. So speaking of go time, so what does Austin Angels and now National Angels, what do y'all do?
Yeah. So we've got two main programs that we do. We have a program that's called the Love Box program, and then we have a program called Dare to Dream. So our Love Box program virtually is this. We wrap intentional community around children and families who are in foster care. We do what's called a need assessment with a volunteer, meaning what are your needs? What are you looking for out of a volunteer experience? And also, what do you have the ability to give? Is it a financial resource or is it time? Because we've got families on a spectrum that says, you know what, we're a foster family, we have no problem with finances, but we could really use the emotional support. Or you know what, we'd love to have a respite. We'd love to have one dedicated person that we could reach out to when the mother-in-law comes in to watch the kids for the weekend and we want to get away. You know, so I think families' needs are on such a spectrum. This is not a one-size-fits-all program. And so we match people based on need assessment of the volunteer and also of the family. And then we do matching based on zip code, because we know that if we can get you matched in a program, because you have to commit to at least 1 year. We talked earlier about the fluidity of how many people come in and out of these children's and families' lives. So can we have one dedicated person, one group of people dedicated to one family, and it's a one-on-one ratio, right? And we know that if it's within a 15-minute driving radius, that we could probably create some sustainability within what our program is. If we have to send you on the other side of town where you're fighting traffic and it takes you an hour, it's not a sustainable solution. So we match people based on need assessment and zip code. And so when we do a need assessment with a family, we say, okay, Mr. and Mrs. Smith, you've got two young kids. Are you also looking for a family that is fostering two young kids? Are you willing to go teenagers? What do you feel like called, to support? And so after we do that needs assessment, let's say we match them perfectly, then the actual program, we focus on three areas of impact. So the first area is intentional giving. And what makes our program so unique is that we have holistic support around the entire family, meaning that when a mom and dad decides to foster, so does every child in the home. So whether you're a biological child, an adopted child, or a foster child, you all get treated exactly the same. Because what happens when you're a foster child and you're in the home or a child in foster care, what happens is you've got CPS workers and CASA and attorney at litem and all these people coming to see you, and you've got these bio children or these adopted children. Like, what? Hey, what's going on here? Why does he get all the, you know, whether it's negative attention or positive attention, he's getting all the attention. Mom and dad are now focused on him. And like, what about me? You know? And so we know that the whole family fosters. So can we show up and meet the needs of the entire family? So intentional giving looks like, what are the family's greatest needs? So maybe for mom and dad, that looks like laundry soap, toilet paper, paper towels, a hot meal every Friday, because they both work full time and the idea of one more meal is exhausting to them. So what is the need of the family? And for the children, that looks, what are their favorite snacks? What are their favorite cereals? What are their favorite things? Do they need school clothes or school supplies? Right now it's January, so it's freezing. So does every kid have a brand new coat? Does the family have what they need in order to succeed? Because the worst thing is that we've got a mom and dad who've been called to foster, but they're not getting the stipend that they need. And so now all of a sudden, I can't do this because it's too much of a financial burden on our family, yet I have been called to this work. So it's like meeting those practical needs. And then what do the kids need? And then also, what do they want? And so that's what we give in the actual physical boxes. The things that are not in the box is the relationship building, which is a huge component of what we do. So let's say you've got two young boys who always wanted to be in baseball. We want to make sure that our Love Box groups are making sure that it is within reason that the kids are able to play. So they would pay for the cost of the equipment. They would pay for the entry fee. Maybe they would help coordinate to and from practice. Maybe they would be there on games or a championship to root the kid on. It's basically like an extended part of the family. So the relationship building, we have a saying that every single child deserves at least one healthy adult who knows the color of their eyes and the passions of their heart. We believe that every child has had a spiritual gifting of some sort, whether that's writing or arts or music. And can we meet those needs through the program? And then the last component is mentorship. And so what we say is get an age-appropriate book, get some flashcards, get the matching game, go visit the family, have all the kids go out front underneath the big tree and have a picnic with them. And let's read age-appropriate books to them. Let's play a matching game, flashcards. Let's visit the kids at school and have lunch with them. Let's encourage them with good work and good grades, you know. And for our older kids, that looks like in mentorship, do they have a driver's license? Do they know how to fill out a job application? Do they know how to do a resume? Have they begin to consider and look at where do we go from here? What are the next steps from here? So that's virtually our Love Box program, is meeting the need of the entire family. And that's why we say get with the people that you already do life with, because it is a financial cost. So we as an agency don't have people that come to us and just pay us money and then we go and support the family. We believe in relational healing. We believe that the only way to help mend a broken heart is by having healthy adults show up and pour in. And we know that love is spelled through kids, T-I-M-E. It's about just spending quality time with kids the same way we do with biological children, the same way we do with adopted children. Children who are in foster care are no different. They need time and love and support like we all do. So that's our program.
Yeah. Wow. There is so much there. Gosh, your program, it boggles my mind, to be honest with you. I want to say, first of all, I thank you for like treating all the kids in the home like the same. We always say our kids did not choose adoption, right? That they, you know, that was our choice, just like they didn't choose ministry, you know. But you know, it can get so weird with that, right? Like all these kids getting attention. I think that's super healthy. And just the amount of stuff that you've been able to accomplish with the love boxes and all, like, how? I mean, how do you find people like this? And yeah, how does that happen?
Yeah. You know, first and foremost, I think that God cares deeply about children in foster care, and he cares deeply about orphans, right? Yeah. I mean, we say it's mandate. It's not like, hey, would you? But no, you need to. Yeah. And so I think that anytime we step into what he has called us to do and be and create, that there's just favor in that. Doesn't mean that there's not hard work, because I tell you, we have a bunch of people on our team. And I said this today at the staff meeting. I thank you for choosing us. I thank you for choosing a place where you come to work and you trade time for what you get at the end of this, which is children and families, their lives are changed and their lives are impacted because of this program. And so I think there's favor in this work, you know? And so that's first and foremost. And I think that there has been some success that we have had because of the people who decided to say yes to come and work for a company like ours, who every single day wake up with the idea and the hope that we believe in community. We believe that children should experience care differently. We believe that we can do better than that. And we believe that if we can fully execute our mission, then we have the power to change the world. And I don't say that flippantly. I say that because we know what the statistics say, is that our prison population, our homeless population, our children who are human trafficked, our healthcare costs, they're all so greatly impacted by foster care. So what happens is that a child that enters into care will go through and live a mediocre life at best, only to end up aging out and not becoming who he was created or she was created to be. I believe we can do better than that. I don't believe it has to be this way. In fact, I know it doesn't have to be this way, because I'm reminded of it every single day through our program. So that's how we've been able to do it.
That's awesome. I love that. Can we talk a little bit just about the statistics and just some of the, you know, the why behind what you do?
Yeah. So I think for me, one of the most alarming statistics is that children on average nationally will move 7 times within 2 years. And so I want that to sink in for a moment, because it's not 7 moves. It is seven moves. But what that means is that it's seven new mommies and daddies, new sets of siblings, new teachers, new communities, new schools, new sets of friends, if you even make them. And that's seven times in 2 years. And every time a child moves, the trauma and the feeling of now they don't want me and they don't want me becomes greater and greater and greater. And so that is an alarming statistic that we all should be up in arms about, right? How do we get kids to stay in placement? And then how do we support them? And so for that reason, when we talk about children moving seven different times, every time they move, they're 6 months behind from an educational standpoint. So how do we expect for our children to graduate high school if all they're doing is bouncing around and moving around, much less thinking about schoolwork? So if we can keep a child in placement, we know that the statistics that says 30 to 50% will not graduate. So 50%, let's just use 50% will not graduate high school. Well, what we know is that they are on a path and a trajectory to be in a place where sustainability for their future is going to be real hard. We also know that 97% will not go on to college, even though in most places there's a full ride to any state school that they want to go to. So 97% will not go on to college. I mean, that's huge. And nationally, 50% of our homeless population. And we have red stats, but we have not been able to cite them this year. So I don't know what it is this year, but the majority, the strong majority of people who are in prison spent time in foster care. And
yeah, those,
I mean, it's alarming, you know, and I think people think, well, gosh, if I'm not called to foster and I'm not called to adopt, I can't do anything. But the truth is that each one of us has the power to change someone else's life, and that no child deserves this. And God did not create these beautiful children to grow up only to end up aged out and end up committing a low-level crime after a low-level crime. You know, I think we've all been guilty of it, especially here in Austin. I feel like this is one of the greatest cities in the whole world. You know, I know that's up for negotiation.
Now, Austin's pretty legit.
Yeah. But we are also the hub of homelessness. So at any moment when you're driving downtown, you will see some, you know, person holding a sign asking for money. And I think people will say, gosh, we live in the greatest city in the world where there's so much, you know, possibility. Can't you get a job? And I think it's easy for us to say that. But what's not easy is to understand that it is a catastrophic loss of family that has gotten that person to that place. And I think that I could just go on for days. I'm on my soapbox, but
I love this. Is a great soapbox. I'm in. Yeah. I'm in on this. Yeah. No, it's great. Those statistics just absolutely destroy me. Like you talked about the prison population, 50% of homeless population spent time in. I mean,
yeah. I mean, what would this world look like if the majority of our prison population was empty? And what would it look like if we could pull 50% of the people off the streets? And what about our healthcare costs? And what about the amount of children who are human trafficked? And how about the fact that when girls are 19 years old, they'll already be on their second pregnancy and 75% of those kids will reenter. There's so many generational curses that happens within foster care. How do we expect there not to be? It's not like we're equipping them and giving them every opportunity to rise to their fullest potential. No, that's not what happens here. They get shifted through a system that only fails them. They get out and then what? You can't expect them to succeed. No one could. It's very hard to overcome what they have been put through. But this is not a statistic. You know, this is not only a problem based on statistic. This is human capital we're talking about. This is the fact that Jimmy always had a dream maybe to grow up and become a police officer or an attorney or an esthetician and we could literally go and say every single job that would go back and impact our community. These children want a way in which to give back. They want a way in which to contribute back to society like everybody else. They don't want a hand out. They want a hand up. There is a difference, you know?
Yeah, totally. I totally get that. So do you think that, obviously support is a huge role in that. Do you think that support is the key
to keeping most foster care cases in care without having to bounce around to these other homes?
Absolutely. I think, you know, we know statistics say that 50% of first-time foster parents will close their home within 1 year because they were not equipped and not supported. When you become a foster parent, you legally are now a government-owned piece of property where you don't get to say, you know what, we'd love to have you over, Mr. and Mrs. Caseworker and all these people. Come on in and have dinner. No, it's we're coming in for a visit. And oh, now we need you to take the kid to this 3 visits a week. And there's so many things that foster parents have to do. And they're exhausted and they're tired. And the CPS worker is not coming in. While they do great work, I am not bashing our caseworkers. They are amazing people doing great work. But the problem is that they're not coming in and saying, Pamela, we see that you have a hard kid. I know that you are crying all night long because you think, what have I done? I have destroyed my family. This kid hates me. I'm not doing a good enough job. They're not coming in and saying, I see you. This is hard work. You're doing a great job. Keep it up. They're coming in and saying, have you done this? Have you done that? What about this? Da, 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 da. Okay, bye. And there's not a whole lot of warm and fuzzy. So I tell you what makes, I think, the biggest impact. Number one is consistency. Having somebody identified that shows up and roots for you over and over and over again. And the feeling of I'm not in this alone is, I think, the greatest thing. I read an article recently about, you know, when we scale a mountain, if we have to do it all alone, that mountain looks really hard, almost impossible to do. If we can do it with a group of people, all of a sudden now we look at that mountain and we say, you know what, I probably could scale that. You're in this with me. I think we could get up to the top together. And that's what the difference is. I think we can go and enter into really, really hard things in life. I think we were made to enter in to do hard things, but it feels impossible when we do it alone. I think that's the power in our program, is that you are not in this alone. And so when your kid has now bashed through the window because he's afraid to love you, and so let me bash through this window or put a hole in your wall or have this huge tantrum because I'm afraid that if I give you my heart, you will hurt me like everybody else.
Right.
And the parents on the other end are like, I've got this kid who I love, but he keeps banging holes in my wall and I'm frustrated. To be able to call a love box leader, to be able to call your person and say, this is what's happening. And I'm having a hard time, for that love box leader to show up, to say, you know what, let me take Jimmy to the park. Let me take him to a boxing class and let him run out some aggression. Let me show up for him and for you. Guess what, mom? Open your door because I just put coffee and muffins at your door. I know you were up till 2 o'clock in the morning. You've got a sweet surprise there. You're doing a good job. How about a sweet Pinterest quote that's been texted to you, or a Bible scripture if you're a faith, you know, to get you through this hard thing? That I believe we can do these hard things if we have the community and have the consistency. That's the proof in the pudding, I think.
Amen. I just want to keep shouting amen at you. So I love that. Preach it. It's such good stuff. And people just don't get what trauma looks like in a child who has experienced the sort of things that kids in our foster system have, right? Like people, when I talk about some of the foster care stories that I've heard in my, you know, in the conferences and whatnot that parents that I talk to, it is mind-boggling what these parents go through because these kids are exhibiting behaviors that are just bizarre because of their trauma.
Absolutely.
Do you have what are some resources that you might send people to like maybe get a grasp on some of like the reality of foster care? Do you have things like that off the top of your
head? Well, I would say first and foremost, if you're considering entering into foster care, I would begin to visit with placement agencies and ask them referrals for other foster families. You need to dive in deep to really understand the complexity of what you're getting into. And so I think, you know, any resource where you can find a network of people who are already doing it, that's going to be your first and foremost, your best thing. Anytime you've got somebody who paints a picture that this is perfect and flawless and it's the greatest thing, you better run the opposite direction, because you want people to tell you the truth. This is hard work, but it's doable and it's needed. And I think, you know, we really like to guard our hearts and say, ooh, I don't know if I'm built for this. You know, this feels like I don't know how to love on babies, and then let them go. I would check you just like the CPS worker checked me, that said, you know, this isn't really about you. This is about a child who so desperately needs you to kind of put your feelings aside and offer love and unconditional support. to a child who needs it so desperately. And I would also say there's tons of research and forum groups online, you know, in your community, there's bound to be a foster care network group. And I would say for resources in terms of you want to dive in more, you want to know more. We had talked about this earlier, but TBRI, Trust-Based Relational Intervention, is that what that stands for? Yeah. Is maybe one of the most incredible thing that has come out the last, I don't know, what is it, 10 years, that offers incredible knowledge to how to parent any child, but really how to parent children from hard places. So all of our principles that we have are TBRI. We've got somebody on our board and we've got a practitioner that is within our network. And, you know, I think that's a great thing to just get into and read and learn more.
Yeah. Thanks for that. I appreciate that. Thank God for that CPS worker that you sold a house to.
I know.
Right? Like yes. That boggles my mind. And was it a woman? That she would have the spiritual fortitude to like call you to the carpet like that is incredible.
Well, I tell you, that's just who she is as a human being, you know, the kind of kick in the pants that everybody needs, you know?
Yeah. That is so cool. So you're running a big nonprofit now. You're expanding across the country. What are some of the ways that sort of your vocational history prepared you to do the sort of stuff that you're doing now?
Yeah. So I think that's funny because if I look in my background, if I was, or, you know, looking at my resume, I would say that there's nothing in there that equipped me to do nonprofit work, but that's actually not true. So my degree in college was kinesiology. And I thought that in my life, I was going to go and do some pre-med kind of PA. I wanted to be a physician's assistant for an orthopedic surgeon. That was my greatest dream in life. Ended up not doing that and ended up selling homes for a living and was a corporate trainer for our division. So my responsibility was to hire and train and develop, and those skills have certainly translated. But when you work for, I work for the second largest builder in the nation. So the amount of excellence, and it was a company that's been around for 60, 70 years, but the amount of excellence that they executed, every detail, is something that I feel like has transitioned in the nonprofit sector for me, because I believe that even though, and we are a small nonprofit, so we are not playing with the big dogs like United Way and Big Brothers Big Sister. We don't have a $300 million operating budget. We have a staff of 10 people in Austin. So we are not a massive nonprofit. We are still very small. But just because we're small and just because we have a small budget doesn't mean that we don't operate in a place of excellence that I expect from every single one of my team members. Whether it's the social media marketing, whether it's our case managers, whether it's our CFO or our development team, that every single person is held to a certain standard of excellence. And excellence to me doesn't mean that I expect perfection, because I am not that kind of leader. But what I do expect is that you show up every single day and you give it your all every single day. Because on the other side of that is a child who needs you to do that, you know. Just last week, I had one of our chapters come in. The president was talking to me and saying, you know, I'm having a hard time with one of my team members is, well, just not seeing the real value in posting from social media every week. And I had to tell this leader that we have gotten so many Love Box leaders signed up because of social media. And it needs to be this, is that for me, the number one criteria that I look for is passion. When we are calling people to this work and adding team members, is, do you have the passion for this? Does this keep you up at night? Are you losing sleep over the fact that children are being treated like this in our community? Because the truth is that if you don't care and you're not passionate about this work, then all I get from you at the end of the day is a job. I am not looking for you to just do a job and check a box. I am looking for excellence. I'm looking you to come in every single day and give it your all. And so that was kind of one of the traits and skills that I had from my executive career, is that we just operated in that place and we didn't even talk about it. So internally here in Austin and nationally, we have this hashtag excellence in everything. And anytime one of our employees does something, the whole team will just write back like hashtag excellence in everything. And so I think that that's maybe one of the greatest skill sets that I received from working at that builder, is that I just expect it from every social media post to every time we interact with a child or a family or a child placement agency or a donor. Everyone gets treated the same. And I think that's what I've learned. And then there's some other hard skills, but nobody cares about that, you know, leadership stuff and, you know.
I think leadership's important, though. My wife's a social worker. She has been for 15 years. And we have been through some really poorly run nonprofits, right? I mean, it's easy for some reason, nonprofits, I think, are a little more prone to allowing ill-equipped people to rise through the ranks, right? So what do you do to sort of make sure, besides the excellence piece, what do you do to make sure that stuff like that isn't happening in your organization?
So good. So I'll tell you that running a nonprofit versus a for-profit, there's one difference, and that's a tax code that allows, the 501c is a tax code, and that is the only difference, I believe, between running a nonprofit and for-profit. Now, with that said, there's a lot of things that make running a nonprofit more challenging, you know, difficult, because you're not selling an actual product where you get money back in return. I sell you this lipstick and here's my margin. And so now I take this margin and yada, yada, yada. Right. What I'm asking people to do is invest in little Jimmy, who's two. And then I'm going to ask you to reinvest next year and the year after that and the year after that and the year after that. And that you constantly are in this with us, that it takes a whole community to go on this journey with us. And so that's where it kind of becomes, I think, different and complicated. But the truth is, you sell lipstick, you want them to come back next year and sell lipstick again and again. So I don't know if that's a great valid point, but
that's how I sell lipstick, at least. So
there you go. Yeah. There you go. But I believe that we need not more nonprofits, that it's so hard to get from a place of, I care deeply about this, so I got to go and run a nonprofit. Yeah. We don't need more nonprofits. We need better run, more efficient, more effective nonprofits. Yes. And that's the difference. So I tell people a lot of times, like, if you are passionate about whatever, then go and find another nonprofit who's already doing that and say, I'd like to help. Where can I help? Because I guarantee you, somebody calls me today and says, I care deeply about children in foster care and I want to be a part of what you are doing. Can I volunteer? Can I help? Is there something that I can do? In fact, I have two people that are committed to coming to my staff meetings every single Tuesday as a volunteer because they want to learn and they want to roll up their sleeves and they want to do something. They want to be a part of it. They don't want a job. They want to be a part of the solution. So I would say, don't go and start your own nonprofit. Go find a nonprofit that's already doing what you want to be doing and then help them become more resourceful. Mm-hmm. And I think most nonprofits fail because when we talk about, you know, the business side, this is a business. You have to create a strategic plan. You have to create a budget. When you are running a nonprofit in my position, the bigger that you grow, the harder that it is to stay connected to center facing the client of whatever it is that you're doing, right? Yeah. Because I'm managing every single person and big picture and growth plan, that I'm not in the weeds of doing the matches and seeing the children. However, it is a rule that when you're within our organization, you have to be a part of the Love Box program because I want you to stay connected to what it is that we're doing. You know, you have to. But I would say, you know, there is no difference. You have to run this like it's a for-profit company. You have to have swim lanes and boundaries and strategic plans and budgets, and you have to have the oversight of marketing, and you have to invest in this company.
Yeah. Wow, that's great. You actually answered my next question, which was how do you make sure and keep the main thing, and not get lost in all the weeds? But I mean, keeping people a part of the Love Box program is brilliant.
They have to, whether they're sitting on a board or whether they're a staff person, or whether they're a chapter.
Your board sits on, does Love Boxes?
Absolutely, they do.
That's amazing.
Absolutely,
that's awesome.
They do. Yes.
Wow. That's all. I love that. I think that I'm getting so many good thoughts, and that's cool. I appreciate you talking about that.
Yeah.
So, all right. We are trucking right along here. Okay. So Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit just about success stories from maybe your programs. Are you okay to talk a little bit about some of that?
Absolutely, yeah.
So what have you seen happen with your programs you're running?
Okay, so what I would say in terms of some of the success stories, there's a few that really, really, really stand out to me that I'd love to share. So we have a little boy that's in our program that we actually launched the pilot program with, and we'll just say his name is, I don't know. He's no name. No, we can't. We have to give him a name. Damien. Damien is his name.
Okay. Okay.
So Damien grew up in foster care, and he was in a home where it was kind of the last stop for him before he would ended up in a residential treatment center. He was entering into seventh grade. And when we started the Love Box program with him, he really had no self-esteem. I mean, couldn't look at people in the eyes and just was completely withdrawn. And his foster mom had said, out of every boy that I've had in my home, because I've fostered over 50 boys, he is the worst case of any boy that's ever been through my home. Mm-hmm. And so the Love Box group really was intentional with him. And I think loved on him well, gave him time to feel comfortable with them. And anyways, it was August, and every year we do a big thing for back to school. And in his backpack that he had received, a brand new backpack with all of his school supplies, he had opened it up and he had read there was a card in there. And in the card, it was like some kind of Dr. Seuss quote. But the Love Box group said, "We understand that you want to go out for the football team this year." And he said, "I do, but it's never going to happen for me. It's never going to happen because I don't make good grades. In fact, I've never made a good grade a day in my life." But this group was so good and kept showing up and loving on him. And they said, "We want you to take this note. We want you to put it on your poster board. And every morning when you wake up, we want you to understand that we have already prayed over you and before you, and that we feel like this is your year. We want you to get up and read that out loud to yourself." And that young man, every single morning, got up and he read that quote card out loud. And he knew that he had people who were championing him. And so at progress report card time, his foster mom calls and says, "You are never going to believe this. The boy who couldn't make eye contact, the boy who never picked his head up, the boy who had no self-esteem whatsoever has just brought his report card home and made straight A's." Mm-hmm. And at that moment, I knew that we had something special, if nothing else, because we just made a young man believe in himself for the first time. But I know we changed his life, because now he feels, while I don't have control over the situation that I'm in, there are some things I can control. My attitude, my grades, how I respond to things. We have equipped him to believe in himself, and that changed everything for that young man. So he made the football team and now has been a shining star on the football team for quite some time. The Lovebox group goes and watches him score touchdowns and years of loving on this kid that now has aspirations to go on and play college ball, you know, or if he decided not to, at least he's been a part of something and feels community through his football team and his Love Box and his family. And so that's one of my favorite success stories, is that in the same home, we had another boy who had been in many different placements, and it was his birthday. And all the Love Box group couldn't be there for his birthday. So what they did was they put a box together, and inside the box, they got cake and all these things to make him feel really loved and special. And on his birthday, they had the box delivered to his house. He couldn't, you know, they couldn't be there. So when he got home from school, he knew he would get to open the box. And he called the Love Box leader and said, "I want you to know that I was so excited to get home from school today, because I knew that for the first time someone was going to celebrate me, that I had never been celebrated before on my birthday. And I just want you to know that I love you." And the foster mom said, "I want you to know how profound that is, that that boy has been in my home for years and has never said the words, 'I love you.'" And so what we know is that if we show up for these kids, that they have the ability to feel love and give love. You know, we hear that thing over and over again, that hurt people, right? Yeah. And so how do we expect these kids to grow up and contribute back to society and fully live into who they are if they don't ever really get the sense of belonging? And I feel like, believe in my heart, that it should be a basic required need, just like shelter, just like food, just like water. Everyone wants to feel the sense of belonging. And that's what makes our program powerful and special, because every kid should feel that sense of belongingness.
Man, I love that so much. That is awesome. I mean, it's just crazy how much stuff can change if somebody's actually in your corner, right? These kids have never had somebody in their corner, like, backing them.
That's right.
You know, everyone they've ever trusted, like, has abandoned them in essence, you know, in their minds, you know? And so, gosh, that is so cool. Thanks for sharing those stories there.
Yeah, you bet.
Do you mind talking just a little bit about how your faith plays itself out in what you do, since we are on a theology of hustle and such, you know?
Yeah, I love it. It's perfect. And it certainly is well-suited for what I do. Yeah. In fact, I was just having a conversation earlier with a gal about how my faith is, I believe, the compass in which I lead this organization. So we are not a Christian organization. It just so happens that the leadership of this team and the people who are a part of this in that capacity are all people of faith. But we serve every family, despite what they believe. So we have Jewish families, you know, that we serve. We have same-sex couples that we serve. We have Muslim and atheist, and we do not discriminate against any person. That if you are fostering and you have a child in your home that is a child that's in the foster care system, we will love you and we will support you like we support everybody. So literally, we treat everyone the exact same. It is not in our model to say that we will only serve a population like this. No, we serve and include every person. My faith, I am so in the belief that this is what God wants me to do with my life. I feel like, not that it is my responsibility, because who do I think that I am? This is God we're talking about. And either I will be obedient and do this, or he will call somebody else to do this. Right. I believe that. Yeah. And so I certainly don't hold myself in a place where it is me, because it is not me. And it is not this team. It is the skills that God has given us along the way so that we could ultimately do and enter into this work. So for me as a leader, my faith is so important, and literally every prayer is to give me godly wisdom, to know what to do. Go before me and help me to know where to say yes and where to say no. And I pray that God would bless every decision. And I also selfishly pray that he would protect us from hard lessons. Yeah. Little lessons I'm okay with, but I'm not wanting to make a bomb mistake, you know? And so that is where faith plays a role in my leadership. And I would say that every person that's here has their own story that has led them here. But for me, it is what I feel like I am supposed to do with my life.
Yeah. All because a CPS worker told you it wasn't all about you.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's good to be reminded, because we can get up in arms. And early on in my career, I really felt the weight of this. And I had a mentor say exactly those words to me, that, Susan, you know, I think that's sweet that you think that this is your responsibility, but is in fact not you, that this is God we're talking about here. And that was the greatest blessing that anybody could give me, because it made me step back and go, right, that's right. This is not about me or us. But what he can do through us.
Yeah. Amen. Okay. So I have a little bit of a question. I think this might be just personal edification for me, but I wanted to pick your brain about this. I saw on Instagram maybe yesterday or something, but you posted a quote from Rachel Hollis's book about ambition.
Yeah.
And I saw your whole post. Did she actually quote you? She talked about you in the book?
Okay. She did.
Ambition though. I find it fascinating. And I guess maybe sometimes I'm afraid of my own ambition. You know, I feel like maybe, I don't know. I don't know if I want to blame this on Christianity or society or what, you know, but like having too much ambition can, I mean, I think people see it as a negative sometimes. Right.
So you do?
I don't know. I think I'm afraid of my ambition because I'm afraid that it might lead me to do some, I don't know, might lead me to become a different person, a person that, you know, does that make sense?
Sure. Absolutely.
So I loved the quote, and I loved you taking a hard stand on ambition, because I think it's important. Can you just talk a little bit about your philosophy behind some of that?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Well, first I would say that maybe you need to go lay down on a couch and talk to somebody.
Well, I do that. So, you know, I'll bring that up next time.
There you go. So. I don't know. I'm certainly not an expert to speak about this, but for me, it goes back to what are we called to do? And I think, you know, it's okay to have ambition for big, humongous things, and it's okay to do small things too, because not everybody is called to have a mega church. Some people are called to have a small church. Right. Some people are called to have big families. Some people are called to have small families. And I certainly don't want to minimize that each one of us has a responsibility to fully become who we're created to be, right? You've heard that thing that the two most powerful days in a person's life is the day that they were born and the day that they find out why they were born. Mm. And so I think it's more about being in prayer about what God wants out of your life and what does he want for your life, not at the benefit of you, but what is the benefit of other people? Because our giftings that have been given us are not for us. I have a girlfriend, her name is Amber, and she can sing like no other person on this planet, yet she never sings. And I say, that gift was not for you. That gift was for everybody else. Right. Don't withhold those gifts. And so I think when it comes to ambition, for me personally, it's God, what do you want out of my life? And I didn't envision that I would create a nonprofit that would serve every single foster child across the nation. I had this very myopic view that can I serve kids in Austin? And then he took that and he expanded that. Right. And so it's not our ambition and it's not about what is this going to do to me or my family and what kind of sacrifice is this going to be? It's what do you want from me? And if you will open up doors, then I will faithfully walk through them. So I think ambition, if it's for yourself, can be bad. But I think if it is for the good of the kingdom, and if it is good for other people, and it's not about you, then it's fine. It's great. So that's what I would say. I don't know if that's helpful.
No, it's super helpful. I don't think I've ever like maybe had a conversation about that, or I don't think it's like big in the. I don't think we talk about it enough, maybe. I don't hear about it enough, you know?
Yeah.
And so I think it's helpful coming from somebody else, like just how they view all that stuff, you know? So
yes.
Thanks for being willing to travel down that little rabbit hole.
Absolutely. I like it.
Okay. So let's jump into our final two questions. Cause I can sit here and talk to you like this pretty much the rest of the day. So,
okay, let's do it.
Okay. So my first question is, what is the strangest job that you have ever had?
Well, I certainly don't think it's a strange job, but it is a job that taught me so much. And that was a job that I had when I was 16 to 18 years old. It was my very first job. And I mean, you know, I feel like I can be long-winded and go on and on about all the lessons that I learned, but I walked in to be a hostess at a restaurant and the manager said, well, I don't have that position open, but I do have a busser position open. And would you like to work at this nice restaurant and bus tables? And I thought, well, you know, I don't know. Do I want to do that? I want a job. So yeah, I'm going to do it. So for 2 years of my life, I bused tables at
Macaroni. 2 years?
2 years. Wow. And won the award as a high achiever, number 3, as the busser of the year. You know,
there was a busser of the year award, huh?
I won it. And then it was so good for me, though, because I worked with people who were so much older than me in the restaurant business at the time. And there's just something, a rite of passage to adulthood when you work into a restaurant and you learn what it means to make a dollar bill. And it also reminds me, a couple of years ago, I got to hear Colin Powell speak, who is such a dreamboat. When he speaks, it's like, you know, amazing.
Yeah, I heard him at Global Leadership Summit a few years ago. He's awesome.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Well, I don't know what he talked about with you, but what he talked about in the conference was just that, you know, it doesn't matter if you're the president of the United States or you're the person sweeping the floors, that each person has a job to do. And it's all so interdependent of one another. And I learned now as an adult, you know, how valuable it was for me to grow up in a position and early on to have to, you know, work hard so that people could sit at tables and like, you know, every person has a role. And so anyways, that's kind of the strangest thing was cleaning dirty dishes off of a table, I guess.
That's amazing. 2 years is a long time to bust tables.
It is. So
that's impressive.
Yeah.
That's impressive. All right. So finally, what is one piece of advice you would give to somebody looking to bring God's kingdom into their work?
Oh, I love it. That's a good question. Well, I would say it's not a lost art to spend time in prayer, because I think that we have different agendas than what God has. And I think that, you know, no matter what you do, that you can do it. You know, I think that you can make light and beauty in any situation. I bring God with me everywhere that I go, because that is who I am, you know. And I think you can bus tables and bring Jesus. I think you can be an insurance person. I think you can run a nonprofit. I think you can be a salesperson or a teacher. That not that you have to stand up on a table and scream, you know, at the top of your lungs that this is who you are, because people will notice what is it that you're doing, and why are you so, you know, in this way. And you invite people in a warm way to enter into this, you know, to enter into it. I think that's how.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a great answer. I appreciate that.
Yeah.
It's a reminder we all need, right?
I think so. Good.
Well, it's so good to talk to you. I'm so excited to hear about the organization and all that stuff.
Thank you. Well, you can stay tuned by just, you know, hanging out on our Instagram. We're on all Instagrams. We have a lot of fun on our Instagram. And we have a really fun team, and we try to make this work fun, because you can certainly get down in the sadness of it, or you can choose to focus on the hope of what we're doing. And we do that. We have fun. You know, we're serious, but we have fun too. So it's sometimes fun to watch. So you can find us on Instagram. Yeah.
I love it. I'll make sure everybody can find that in the show notes and all that stuff, and
great,
follow you and all that stuff.
Great.
Well, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You bet.
Well, I hope you enjoyed hearing from Susan, and I hope you enjoyed our little chat about foster care. If you want to learn more about what Susan does, about foster care in general, look in the show notes. All of her stuff is there. You can easily access it. It is such an important topic, and I think at the very least, we need to be educating ourselves on what foster care is, how we can be involved. If you're not called to foster it in this season or ever, you are called to do something, and her organization, Susan's organization, is a great way to do that. Check them out, look them up, make sure you're following them on all the socials. It's really important work. So I love it. I'd love to hear what you thought about the interview. If there were some new ideas or whatever that you got out of the interview that you hadn't thought of before, let me know on social media. I'd love to get the conversation going about what foster care is, what we can be doing. So hit me up, let me know. And until next time, get out there and hustle.